Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Ascot. Now, we're talking GLP-1 again, but this time, as well as taking in the current impacts on the food industry, we're looking at what happens when people come off the drugs. What kind of consumer are you left with, and how do you cater to them?
So this session is all about GLP-1. And we've heard a lot about this, so we will do a bit of a deep dive on this topic and what happens when people are on GLP-1 and when they stop taking GLP-1. So we've got a great panel for you this morning. They're all going to introduce themselves in a minute and say a few words about what the GLP-1 means to them and how it impacts their everyday life, not themselves, but possibly themselves, but also in their job. And then we will have a few questions and answers amongst ourselves here. And then I will open the floor to you for your questions. So please make sure you think of questions. Make the most of these sessions, because they've been designed for you to ask questions, all the things you wanted to ask but haven't been answered, or a question that hasn't come up but you really want to know the answer, or something is not clear. Just make sure you put your hand up, and there will be time for you during the session. And at the end, we will wrap up, and I will ask each of the panelists to give you one takeaway for you when you go back to the office tomorrow. So, are we ready for this?
Yeah.
Let's go. Right. Good. Let's start. Do you want to introduce yourself, Julian?
Yes, Your Honor. Hi, I'm Julian Sibotaro. I'm the MPD manager at Rue Nutrients. We are food manufacturing, focusing on nutraceuticals. So we collaborate with over 300 brands, from early stage startups to industry leaders. And my role is to use my broad category exposure to collaborate with brands, supporting them develop bespoke formulations, choosing new ingredients, or scalable manufacturing. One of the important part of this role is how to balance the precision of bespoke supplement with the efficiency of commercial execution to ensure that end product will be successful.
Thank you. And the sort of the questions about the one opportunity that the GLP-1 create for the industry.
So a few years back, you know, if you look at, if you are telling someone that you take a drug that helps you lose weight, eat less, effortlessly, that sounded impossible. You know, these days it's all over social media. And that changes how we think about metabolism, appetite. And if it's for the first time where consumers are experiencing how it feels like not to be driven by hunger. And there we see where supplements, they are like high in fiber, high protein, slow release carbohydrates, are really coming into place.
Interesting. We're going to explore this a bit further, but that's very interesting. Sonia.
Hello, everybody. My name is Sonia Huppert. I work for IFF, and I'm a global innovation business development for an area that we call Reimagined Wellness. So what IFF is doing, IFF is a global supplier in ingredients and flavors for the food industry, that's why I'm here, but also for home personal care as well as fragrances. So today, as I'm working on the food and beverage side, we will focus on this area. And the link and why GLP-1 is important for us, it's because it's important for the food and beverage industry, and we are daily helping our customer to make successful product to fulfill the need of the consumers. And we will discuss, in fact, today that GLP-1 is transforming the way that consumers interact with food, as it does alter the taste and texture perception of food. But we will go through this after.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning, everybody. My name is Dr. Taran Tor. By background, I'm a practicing clinician for 15 years, and I was duly trained as a public health and as a health economist. and most of my career I've worked as a clinician and in entrepreneurship, and I pivoted across into industry. And really my role is working at Holland & Barrett is driving the next generation of health and wellness ventures. So looking at strategic profit pools and how we can convert that science into a consumer-centric proposition. So at Holland & Barrett, I am the Group Director of Wellness Innovation. If you're not familiar with Holland & Barrett, we are the Europe's largest health and wellness retailer. So we're in 700 stores in the UK, about 700 outside, operating in 20 countries. And I'm really excited to be here today.
Thank you. So I think before we go any further, I think it would be very helpful if we were to define, you know, or provide some information about what is GLP-1 and what sort of what are they and what sort of different formats and could they come in different sizes, and shape, and names on there?
Yep. Absolutely. So yeah, I think GLP-1 sounds quite novel for a lot of people, but for those working in big pharma or as a clinician myself, it's pretty much old news actually. So the therapeutic journey started 20 years ago this year, so 2005. And this started as a treatment for type 2 diabetes. What we noticed was the potent weight loss that was associated with type 2 diabetes. The pivotal moment really came in 2021 when the FDA in the USA approved GLP-1 for weight management or weight loss. And then in the subsequent years, in 2022, 2023, those approvals extended to Europe, Australia, the UK. So what is GLP-1? In a nutshell, an oversimplification perhaps is that GLP-1 is a hormone that is produced in your gut. It's a feel-full hormone. And what we're essentially doing is pressing the button to make you feel a little bit fuller for longer. So how that actually works is three or four ways. It slows the gut motility. It suppresses a couple of hormones, including glucagon. Glucagon helps you to release glucose, and it switches on insulin to minimize the amount of glucose that's hanging around in your body. So at a very simple level, it's a blunt tool to suppress your appetite. But actually, we'll talk a little bit more about this, it's so much more. I would very much describe this as a trend breaker because of the impact it's having indirectly and directly across physiological pathways in the body. So impacting how you think and your fit, and the kind of how you interact with what we are very much living in now, a very aggressive obesogenic environment. So nudging you without you really realizing in terms of picking healthier choices, eating less, wanting to drink alcohol, sweet, that kind of flavor profile is massively changing. Just to give you a sense of the numbers.
Numbers and also the words, I think people know about Wegovy or Ozempic or yes. That, but there are quite a few of them.
Yeah, they're essentially brand names. So glucagon-like peptide inhibitor is GLP-1. And you have various different molecules or compounds. So Wegovy, or which is semaglutide, I'm Manjaro and so forth. And actually it's just various different names for different compounds. And what will be interesting is as we get new compounds, they'll work to help curtail some of the side effects. But just to give you a sense of the numbers, they're absolutely astounding. So if you look at the US where there's an early adoption, there's 25,000 new people a week taking this up. So it's estimated in the US, 10 to 12% of adults have taken this. In numbers, in real numbers, that means 25 to 35 million adults. And when we look at what they're doing at an individual level and a population level, the impact on the wellness industry, nutraceutical industry is profound. In the UK, we're thinking the uptake is about 1.5 million. So it's pretty staggering, actually. And most of these are out of pocket, people paying out of pocket.
Yeah, because some are prescribed about 70,000 or something. Yeah,
so if you look at the 1.5 million, there's minimal numbers that are prescribed. And why do we think that is? Well, there's 15 million people in the UK living with obesity or being overweight. 15 million people. If I, as an NHS doctor, was to pay for all of those, could we guess how much that may cost the NHS? Take a guess.
10 billion a month.
It would be 45 billion for that cohort because you'd have to support them over 2 years. So yeah, it's just not sustainable. What that means, though, it's produced a very fertile ground for new and non-traditional incumbents to occupy this space. However you might think about that, that fertile ground and innovation and new people who are serving this massively unmet demand is profound, especially when you look at who those people are, which are typically right now people who perhaps don't really need it. They're the most obese, they're not the most obese people, but they've got the thickest wellness wallet.
So the main way people are getting GLP-1 at the moment is an injection.
That's right, and that's perhaps because it's an injection form right now. There's a cost associated with that because it needs to be held in what we call the cold storage supply chain. That will massively change when the pill format comes, and that is already being developed, and that will be released probably next year. So at the moment, most people, when we could talk quite a lot about this, yeah, most people are using this now once a weekly injection for weight management. The way we're going to be using this will continue to change massively. So at the moment, it's purely weight management, and the thinking is that you'll come off there. But if you look at the US and some of the thought leaders there, if you have a fraction of the dose or microdosing together with an effective wraparound, you may be on this for a very, very long time. So okay. And then the way you use it and the format might also change.
I think the way you ingest it is probably because obviously the needle is or patches or you mentioned pills, yeah.
Pills were announced to be on the US market early 2026. Okay. So that's what has been for the moment basically announced. Today is only injection, to your point, which we do consider being a limitation on the number of consumer going into it, because of course you need to do an injection by yourself or by someone else. So you get a barrier, in fact, in terms of adoption.
And obviously one of the other barriers, the price.
The cost, correct, definitely.
I hear the generics are coming. So is it next year or the year after? Say soon, isn't it?
The patent is effectively going to expire pretty soon, which will open the way for generic. That's correct.
Well, this is quite a topical debate, because if you take generics aside, the hot topic of debate and contention is compound medication. And in the US, this is what some of the big providers like Hims and Hers are dealing with right now. What a compound means is when you can tweak the formulation and legitimately offer that. Why that matters is because it completely disrupts the price. And so that's really profound, because that will disrupt the uptake.
And perhaps on this, perhaps you have seen in the US, Costco did announce yesterday that they will offer these on non-prescription around, I think, $450 or something like this, which is definitely a lower price than most of the medication are currently basically in the US. So it's one step, in fact, further on getting even more consumer under this type of medication.
So we're looking at big numbers here.
Correct.
So, and also there's the black market as well, which we hear a lot about, and there's a whole gray market, parties and things, or people going to various countries where they can access it.
And the black market was especially created that and I think there's still a kind of supply limitation on what the pharma industry could produce for the time being. So then you start getting a black market on this. And also the fact that in a lot of country, you need a prescription to get it. So then you had this creation of black market where people are basically buying it really in the street and don't always know, in fact, what they are getting at some point. But it's very interesting to see how attractive this is for consumers who even go to the black market to get those medications.
Right. So that's quite clear now, and it's quite astonishing, you know, in terms of the size and what's going to become. Let's have a look now at what actually does to you and the body, and how it affects, you know, your relationship with food and how you behave around food and your eating pattern.
So the medication has been developed at the beginning for diabetes, and it has been very well explained. It has an impact on satiety and how much food consumers are basically eating. So what we're observing is that consumers are eating definitively, in fact, less, which trigger, in fact, the weight loss, but on the same point, as they're eating less, they also had taste altered, meaning that they are not liking the same type of food. And we're seeing a big shift for the food and beverage industry, because we're seeing product category declining, like sweets, bakery type of food, snacks, sweet beverages, potentially alcohol, but we also see an increase in other categories like nutritional bars, like yogurt, and especially high protein yogurt. And some, for example, producer had reported really seeing their sales and their revenue increasing in the US in this category, potentially due to the increased number of consumers being on GLP-1. We also see consumers eating much more fresh food, especially vegetables. On studies that we did at IFF, we had consumers telling us that they're craving now for vegetables, for salad, which never happened to them before. So that's really interesting. And the other thing on the food that it does, so then they're eating, in fact, less. It changes preferences, but they're also not drinking. So hydration is as well a problem for those consumers.
By not drinking, not just alcohol.
No, drinking even water. And consumers were reporting to us that they cannot drink any more sweet beverages, but that water is boring. And they're also reporting that they need to think to eat and to drink because the satiety level is very high, so then they don't feel hungry anymore. So they really need to remember that they need to eat, in fact, to get energy and to keep going with the body. Meaning that in terms of things to pay attention to, you definitely have so hydration with all the energy going there, but also muscle mass maintenance, which is a big one where you lose weight too quickly. So that's one that is very important, linking to the need of taking protein and high density food to sustain basically the need of your body on macro and micronutrient. Other things that the drug is doing is side effect on gut health. I don't know if someone wants to talk on this one.
I just wanted to add a little bit more on what you said. Taking a step back a little bit, like for decades, the weight management category was defined by diet, exercise, and stigma. In other words, eat less, move more, and feel bad about yourself when you don't. But GLP-1 has changed that mindset, so consumers are moving from trying to control their weight to looking for products that support their metabolism. So Sonia touched a little bit of indulgent categories. They'll have to make to get a makeover where they can put some high fibers in snacks or blood sugar friendly. So because consumer, they still want the pleasure, but they want some benefits built in. So yes, consumers still want chocolate, but they want it to love them back. So is where we see these new categories like satiety, supporting foods, which they are high in fiber, high in protein, with slow release carbs, healthy fats to make you feel fuller for longer, or metabolic support supplements, which they include botanical, probiotics, and like polyphenols, which support that energy metabolism. Also, as the GLP-1 changes your appetite, then we need to think about flavors, textures, and portion sizes. We know we need smaller portions, but with more sensory satisfaction. Think about the quality of experience rather than the quantity of consumption. So if we zoom back, GLP-1 is doing something that very few innovation managed to, is changing the psychology of eating. So customer rethink what food and wellness are for. So in, I don't know, 5 years time, we might not be talking about weight management altogether. We can talk about metabolic harmony where foods and supplements are designed to help people feel in control and well-balanced. So the real question here is not what people will eat, is how we support them to eat well, feel well, and stay well in this new metabolic era.
And in relation, in fact, to that, that's when they are under medication. But as we talked at the beginning, there's a cost with the medication, and potentially they will not stay forever under medication. And the consumer are reporting being really stressed on stopping the medication because they're stressed on bouncing back, of course, and because what happened to them is not by choice and not because they choose to eat differently and to have a different lifestyle. It's really the medication that is changing the ways that they are eating and interacting with food. So we see that there's also a big need to support them when they go off medication and to help them with products that will continue to basically fulfill them in terms of nutrition, in terms of society, and most probably as well in terms of coaching of what nutrition is.
I'll just double down on a couple of points there. I think one was on this new wellness wallet, so this premiumization effect that Sonia had mentioned. If we look to the US, and as people's preferences are changing, what they're realizing is about $203 a month that's being realized because of a redirected spend away from so-called sinful foods. So not buying your Deliveroo, your junk foods, your takeaways. That $203 a month is being poured into fresh foods, supplements, and vitamins. So that's quite important because it shows actually people are in some ways getting wealthier, or their wellness wallet certainly is getting bigger. Number two, what are they willing to spend on? If it anchors up to the wellness goals, they're willing to spend more on those things. So if the ingredients are clearly beneficial to what they're hoping the wellness will kind of, they're trying to achieve from a wellness perspective, there's that well-established premiumization effect. So it's not about the cheapest stuff or the cheapest products. In fact, they'll buy and pay for, you know, better quality stuff. And the other thing we slightly mentioned is, if we take a step back, the amount of weight people may lose on GLP-1. It's about 20% of your weight. What that means in real time, 20% of my body is probably one limb. So it's quite a significant amount of weight to lose. That's the headline number. But 40% of that right now could be muscle mass that we talked about. And this is what part of the challenge is going to be for people who are providing the medication, but also the industry here. It's how do we educate the consumer so that they can exercise that agency, but make sure they do the right things and take the right things to support their wellness goals. Because if you're losing 40% muscle mass, that isn't great. But then how do you then have enough protein, which is 1 gram per kilogram, but also in ways that you can digest it, in fun ways to be able to achieve that. So there's some of the challenges, but also the strategic opportunities to exploit, really.
We haven't touched on the side effects because they've been well published, but do you want to recap on some of the main side effects that have been reported?
Yeah, I think it's really important to think about side effects and map it back to the life cycle here. So if you think about, there's probably three stages of taking GLP-1. It's at the very beginning. It's then when you're having your weight management, and then as you talked about, when you're tapering off. And there's different side effects and different issues that you'll have at each of these different 3 or 4 stages. At the very beginning, the most obvious side effects are all GI related. About 40 or 50% of people will have nausea or vomiting because there's a little bit of a mismatch between how much they're eating and that slowdown in gut motility. The gut is digesting food very, very slowly. So that mismatch needs to be optimized by smaller meals and plenty of fluids. Nausea can also be curtailed by lots of different things, including being well hydrated and having certain citrusy foods and ginger and so forth. But the other unintended side effect that you may not be aware of is what we talked about, which is muscle mass loss. So that's really important at that stage to be able to optimize.
Is that people going, they need to go to the gym or?
Well, they're losing the wrong kind of weight. So oh. What they'll lose is, and this is when we're talking about a Ozempic face or an Ozempic bum. Because you're essentially, you lose the gut, but you also get a very flat bum that's not aesthetically nice, or you're losing the collagen in your face that isn't aesthetically nice. And that's when you perhaps realize, unless you're a bit more sophisticated provider where you're checking not somebody's BMI, but somebody's actual breakdown of what is their muscle mass. And then how do you then stop doing that? So it is a mixture of gym. But then as Sonia pointed out, if you're not eating very much, you don't have the right amount of energy. So how do you get enough of a nutrient-dense and micronutrient-dense foods inside you so you are energetic enough to exercise?
And on this, when we talk muscle mass, what is really critical is protein. So it's good quality protein and enough quantity of protein that you need, in fact, to get every day. That's a way with exercise to prevent, in fact, this. And then on the story about the Ozempic face, it does create an opportunity on the surgery industry, because that seems also to go up in the US due to this weight that is lost too quickly. But that's for the side story here.
Yeah. So can we just think about now some of the opportunities for the food industry in terms of products that they offer, food, beverages? You know, you mentioned smaller portion, maybe more nutrient or whatever. So what does it mean? What do we need to do now to, yeah. I know some companies have already got a range of products out there. What do we need to do?
So for the food and beverage industry, what's important is to take this as an opportunity to rethink their portfolio and to see how they need to adjust that portfolio on the new requirement of the consumers. When I say the new requirement is high density food when people are under GLP-1, but also being with the consumers when they go off the medication, which probably also represent a bigger, in fact, market, but ensuring to fulfill the new need of the consumers that are going to have a different awareness about food, about what they need. So for us at IFF, we see that as an accelerator of the transformation of the food and bev industry toward a healthier and more nutritious type of product. We are talking in the previous panel about low fat, low sugar. So it's definitely, I think, an accelerator from what the consumer will like to see now on the shelf and on what they want, in fact, to find. So that's where the opportunity is.
So if GLP-1 changed the way we think about metabolism, then the product innovation will change how we support it. And here we see like ingredients that, well, the nutraceutical is not trying to replace the GLP-1. We are trying to have products that support the body's own version of that pathways. And those pathways can lead to brain health, heart health, inflammation. So we see ingredients being studied for this, like beta-glucans, green tea catechins, polyphenols, berberine, bitter melon extract. So we know that GLP-1 is already studied for heart protection. So nutraceuticals is expanding there too with ingredients like omega-3s, curcumin, anthocyanins, and even magnesium are being repurposed for that metabolic toolkit. Also, what is interesting that GLP-1 is not produced only in the gut, it's also produced in the brain, and that will affect the appetite, the motivation, mood. So we see here a combination of prebiotic and postbiotics with adaptogens. Think about fermented fibers with different strains of probiotics, and then you include ashwagandha, rhodiola rosea, or L-theanine.
So I'm conscious, look, we've discussed quite a lot. We've discussed the big problem, we've discussed the uptake, therefore the impact at an individual and population level. I'll try to ladder this down into four simple trends that I think are really relevant for you here. So I think the four key areas I would suggest in light of those things, so in light of the fact that there's loads of people taking this, in light of actually this, they're probably going to be taking a version of this for a very, very long time. And in light of the fact that there's a premiumization effect, they're willing to spend more because they care about their wellness goals. If you remember those four things at the top, the four things underneath would be protein, fiber, fluid, and snacks. So if we look at protein, if you need to have a gram per kilogram of body weight, it's quite hard to get that in. This is an opportunity to think about protein, but also novel proteins, non-animal based proteins, precision fermented proteins. So that's a massive strategic profit pool to think about. How do we get protein in? Not only food, but also snacks and fluid and protein water. Not everybody wants a huge milky drink, protein shots. This is a huge strategic profit pool. So protein's number one. We talked about fiber, the role of fiber, function of fiber, inulin. So not only plays a role in supporting satiety, but also in health and wellness. People are eating less, therefore they're not meeting their fiber goals. That's a real issue. So although protein is really topical right now, fiber is going to be the new protein. Fluid. People are not, we talked about not having enough fluid, but also there's an opportunity. Some people are citing 36%, some people are citing 60% drop in alcohol consumption. That's really difficult because people still want to socialize. They still want to go to a restaurant. They still want to go to a bar. But there needs to be a form of entertainment, not just scoffing yourselves with it. It's about connection. It's about interacting with each other. And therefore, what beverages do you have to support that? There's a real taste fatigue. How many orange juices can an individual have? So there's a huge profit pool there to think about. Not only social drinking, but there's also drinking through protein and protein water and collagen water, benefits infused in water and others and other drinks. And then I said snacks. Snacks are there to stay. People will still want snacking, but there's a huge shift in savory over sweet. And how do you have snacks that support somebody in, and support their wellness goals? We talked about yogurts. We talked about grab-and-go snacks. We talked about lots of other kind of protein-infused snacks and adaptogen-infused snacks. So I would take a step back and think about what are the macro trends here? What are consumer preferences? We talked about the uptake. We talked about premiumization effect. And then I would look at those strategic profit pools, protein, fiber, fluid, and snacks.
Interesting. Thank you for summarizing that.
Yeah, I would like to add one thing, if I can, in fact, here, because thanks for basically this summary, but something for the industry to really keep in mind. You need to be sure that those products are liked by the GLP-1 consumers. Because as we said at the beginning, the taste is changing. So when if you develop product like we're currently in fact doing, your product will not fit those consumers. We did extensive research in the US by understanding what the consumer was looking for. And clearly they don't look to the same size. I think this is almost a given, but they also don't look to the same taste intensity as well as salt, sugar, fat in fact level. So it's a kind of resetting the taste perception. So it's extremely important to readjust this product to those to the new requirement, in fact, of those consumers, taking, of course, into account all the nutritional aspect. And that will be a key thing to be successful on providing consumer new type of product fitting their requirement.
Interesting. Picking up on the Taran point about the social side of things, eating out, and then because for the out of home, you know, the restaurants and that's a huge impact when you've got a party
Correct.
Of people coming in.
Yes.
So is tapas all around or what is it?
It has a big impact. A lot of consumers in the US that we had interview were really saying, for example, just for breakfast, they were not stopping anymore to take a muffin and a coffee. They were making omelette at home, cooking eggs and taking vegetables for breakfast. So a totally different, in fact, way of eating. So this need to be considered in fact as well, and then effectively when they go to restaurant, it's restaurant are reporting really seeing decrease in consumption because they get group of people coming and taking only one meal for four or five person. So that's another change, and some restaurant has started putting different size in their menu to address those consumers. And what's also interesting, because of course we talk about the number of people being on GLP-1, but you get a kind of halo effect because some consumers not being on GLP-1 think that they need to now consume like GLP-1 consumers that they have as friends. So they will not as well eat on the same way and try to mimic how their friends or family are eating. So it's really interesting because again, it's changing, I will say, everything.
The one thing I would say about restaurants, actually, I talked about this term, eatertainment. I think if you're not prepared to innovate, then you're not gonna keep up with the demands. So I think, sure, people are eating less, but you need to dial up the other things, the theater, the experience, the execution. I think when you don't consider those things and you're just hoping for volume, that you're not going to be able to compete. So you've got to think about how do we shift it? How do we make it more of an experience? How do we dial up theater? And that's this whole thing that's coined eatertainment.
Entertainment. And also, interestingly, because they're drinking less alcohol, alcohol plays obviously a big, big part in people, the behaviors and what happens, the interactions. So is that a route for adaptogens or other things that might replace the effect of alcohol?
The one thing I'd say again is like, I hear a lot of sometimes the restaurant industry complaining, but yeah, people are drinking less alcohol, but that doesn't mean they're not prepared to spend on other things. if you don't have alcohol and you just have Coke Zero, that's not good enough, unfortunately. You can have fermented drinks, you can have botanical flavors. You need to really go back to the drawing board and think about innovation and think, actually, what should I do about this? Instead of looking glum and thinking, oh gosh, alcohol sales are plummeting. So what? Low calorie drinks, seltzers, low alcohol drinks. It's a plenty of fertile ground to offer.
Yeah, Julian, have you
I want to add something, in fact, here, because alcohol, they don't go to alcohol, but they don't go, we say, to sweet beverage, but neither to zero Coke, for example, or zero sugar beverage. They don't like this type of product anymore. They even prefer to have lower level of sugar, but no sweetness, no replacement, in fact, of sugar. So that's as well some things that the industry need to consider and where we need to continue to invest and to see how consumers are reacting here.
Okay. Wow, this is fascinating. Time for questions. I know. Right. You're going to be busy with the microphone. It's coming. So the first one, the lady with the flowers, they're very keen.
Hi, I'm Caroline Saunders for Pladis. I have a question for Dr. Tor. I understand there are some new medications coming out that may help with skeletal muscle mass loss. I have a name, Bimagrumab. I wondered if you knew any more about this that you could advise us on.
I can give you some context. So there's about 150 different GLP-1 medications being in development right now. And so what's happening is the new medications like this, they're essentially trying to curtail for some of the side effects. So one of the side effects we talked about was muscle mass loss. So they have a compound in there to help prevent some of that. So that's quite interesting, because, and it's interesting for the food industry, because if you don't have a multi-pronged approach to the innovation, and all of a sudden muscle mass loss isn't as important as it is right now, then you kind of put all of your eggs into one basket. That's the interesting bit, but I think there's something a little bit more interesting than that. I'd say compounds are great, and curtailing some of the side effects, like new compounds, will help to minimize the GI side effects. Interesting, great. What I'm really interested is the people using this at a microdosing level. So instead of you thinking about this traditional life cycle, I take it, I lose weight, I jump off it, I'm miserable, I'll take it again. There may be a situation, and I think the thought leaders in this space, I would look to the US and look at Noom. They've got a very effective wraparound package, and they're saying actually have a fraction of the medication in addition to the things you would normally do, which would then have a compounding benefit. What that means is two really important things. The price point is very different because you're taking a compound and you're taking a lower dose. The other thing is you're not having the side effects at that dose, and therefore you're taking it for a lot longer. That means not only taking the medication for longer, you're taking all of the ancillary spend and taking that for longer. So I think compounds is interesting. Modality is going to be really interesting in terms of pill formats. But microdosing and the intended use case, so not looking at this as just a one-off, but actually how this may well metamorphosize into a staple wellness pill that you may take for the rest of your life, is something I would be interested in observing.
Hi, guys. So you've mentioned a little bit about with the effects, side effects of GLP-1 medication consumers potentially getting less nutrients, lower energy levels. To someone who is maybe not obese, but a little bit overweight, or even in fact someone who's healthy, do you think the benefits of the medication outweigh the negatives and the potential muscle mass? I think you understand the question.
If you ask me, I think there's a lot of nuance in that question. So my background, I'm British Indian. I'm at a very high rate of heart disease. GLP-1, independent of weight management, has been approved for heart disease. There's been a huge trial called the SELECT trial that shows if you take GLP-1, it has a profound impact on your heart risk. One of the biggest uptakes of GLP-1 is in Japan, where obesity levels are minimal. The issue is what we're focused on, a lot of the science is focused on, is are white males right now. But if you're a non-white male, you don't have to be particularly overweight to have a significant risk of heart disease. So I think it depends on what the population is and if you look at the risk associated with that. So not only weight management, but actually the other use cases for GLP-1, heart health is already an established use case for GLP-1. Dementia will be fast becoming an established one. The impact it's having on inflammation and inflammatory markers indirectly of weight management is being profound. So I think if you say what is the, is there risk and benefit, I think it depends on who that individual is, but things like heart disease is certainly a profound indication.
I would like to add something here because it's a good question, but also in my view a very difficult one, because it's about the benefit versus in fact the risks that you will get, especially on the long term. And I will say there's in basically many countries today in the US, but also in UK and other countries in Europe, they are criteria to get those medication under prescription. I think when it's under prescription, it's definitely what you have asked, you get a better benefit versus in fact the risk of taking it. When it's not under prescription, in my view, the question is definitively open because it will really depend of the person. And it's very hard, in fact, to answer today. There's probably much more to learn. But what is interesting is that consumers are still engaging because they really want to lose, in fact, weight. And effectively, the other benefit that seems to be associated to the molecule, but I think we still need to have, in fact, to be cautious, in fact, here. And what we're also seeing on the research that we did is the level of engagement of consumer are different depending on the country. And Europe is, for the moment, the place where the consumer are the more skeptical about the medicine. However, we're still seeing more and more people being on it, and a black market that has started almost everywhere. So you could see that even if when we do research, we see that Europe is more skeptical, consumers are engaging. But your question is definitively a very valid one.
Yeah.
I'd like to add something here. So in terms of the risk, once you're on a prescription, you have a set medication with a certain level, but what body does can build tolerance. So if you need to higher your dosage, that what happens next? Because GLP-1 can change your eating habits, and that sometimes can lead to lower protein or nutrient intakes. So is where there is a need for supplements that restore lean muscle, nourish your gut, or just keep your nutrient level up. And also, as we learned, that appetite is as emotional as is physical. After GLP-1 use or during, then people will have to relearn how to listen to their body. The hunger, fullness, pleasure, and is where supplements like adaptogens, nootropics, and all these ingredients that support gut-brain connections are really needed in the market.
Gentleman with a beard.
Hi, just a quick one. I believe the FDA in America has approved certain front-of-pack labeling when it comes to GLP-1 and something along the lines of supports a GLP-1 friendly diet. Now, obviously, the FDA is very different to the EU and the UK, but just to get your opinion and your view around what front-of-pack labeling is coming down the tracks or could be permissible.
So effectively in Europe, for the moment, there's no claim. And you know that in Europe, the situation to get claim on packaging is taking a very long time very often, so it's probably not coming very soon. And then you do have another thing to take into consideration in Europe. Consumers are not, for the moment at least, talking very openly about being on this type of medication. So the question, I think, is still on the table, and I will see what the other panelists will say, in fact, here. It doesn't mean that putting a claim on the pack will really bring attention. So it's probably more about thinking about what the product does in terms of benefit that could turn the consumers eating products that will be more focused to them.
I think here it's more about consumer education, because in the EU it's really hard to get approved any health claims. You know, they've been trying to approve for many years. They are over, especially on the botanicals, for example, they are over 1,500. They are on hold, which EFSA has to review. But if people don't really use them, or the ingredient manufacturers, they don't invest in clinical trials and support the evidence for that, they'll never be approved. So it's more about educating the consumers what GLP risks are, what they should do during and after. Because if you think GLP-1 works at hormonal level and nutrition works at behavior level. So when you mix them both, you're moving from a pharmaceutical intervention to lifestyle integration. So is where there is need for supplements, and we need health claim approved so people trust the science that is behind that claim.
The longer term effect, as people are eating less, they're looking for more nutrient dense, but also because they're looking for more protein and nutrient dense, do you think there's a risk with regard to your gut because we'll just be eating protein bars and chemicals and UPFs? So, you know, especially after seeing the old killer bar movie, the old, you know, documentary the other day, you know, how bad it is, because it's very quick to reach for a protein bar because I need to have protein, I need to have this. But actually, we might be changing the way of eating completely from real food to chemicals.
I think absolutely, and this is part of the challenge and the opportunity to plug that information asymmetry that exists. I'm going to give you an alternative example to help illustrate my point. When you don't have a huge amount of money, it's kind of irrelevant where that's being invested. If all of a sudden I, on your behalf, are topping up your ISA every single year, where you then invest that money becomes quite interesting. And if you're just investing into a single stock, you don't really have a diverse risk. You don't have a nuanced understanding. It would be my job as your financial advisor then to say, actually, don't put all of your money in gold. Maybe you want to have a risk, diversified risk. We're at the point in time where we're just topping up everybody's ISAs. What I mean by that is people are just bluntly losing weight, but they're not understanding what weight they're using and what are the associated risks. So now it's the job to plug in that information asymmetry. As a financial advisor, it'd be telling you, yeah, you might be getting wealthy, but there's risks with that. So you need to diversify your portfolio to protect you in the long term. It's exactly the same as with health. We've got to think about, okay, how do we plug the information gap and say, sure, you're losing weight, but it might not be great weight. So don't just look at vanity metrics, which is weight loss. Look at protein. But also then thinking about you're eating less. But you could lose weight on GLP-1 on a McDonald's diet. You'll just be taking a bite of a McDonald's meal three times a day and you'll still lose weight. It's not apparent to you till later on that these micronutrient deficient diets impacting you, fibers impacting you, and this is the opportunity. The interesting thing is the person who's on this is very educated and invested because they've been on this for a while, a bit like you'd be interested and invested if 4 years later I've been topping up your ice and you've got a massive cash pile. If you're losing weight and feeling good and the incumbents are educating you on this, you then are looking around and hunting around for these things. What is the best functional fiber? What is the role of my gut here? And how can I have pre, pro and postbiotics to support that? So I think it's a huge opportunity.
And the other thing as well, it's very personal as well. It's an individual would react in different ways. You can't have one size fits all with this, can you? So it's a personal advice from your financial advisor.
Yeah, but I think the biggest problem now is just that, exactly. I think the biggest problem now is people just don't know. They just think, oh, fantastic, I'm getting richer or I'm losing weight. And slowly, as time goes on, they're realizing whether because it's getting a flat bum or a Zempic face, that, oh, hang on, it's not all quite great here.
But that,
or losing hair.
But also that gut-brain axis bit is quite interesting, the impact on that. And
I think people are happy losing weight, so they definitely see the benefits. But you need to think that if your blood sugar is good, then your appetite is under control, your energy is steady, your mood is good, then that's not a diet, that's quality of life. And that's what consumers want. So they will be educated in living a more natural lifestyle. It's either they are on GLP-1 or not. It's all about consumer education. And the other interesting thing is just how is so the future is not necessarily getting thinner, it's being more metabolically intelligent through foods, drinks, supplements that you consume that help you feel well balanced. So the real innovative story is about, you know, being in this metabolic state.
Thank you, Ramesh. Right, a round of applause for our panel. Thank you so much. Amazing information here being shared, and I hope you have a lot. You've learned a lot this morning. Thank you, Taran, Sonia, and Julian.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Before you go, we have some exciting news to share. In 2026, we're hosting two major events. We'll be in London in June, and we're back in Rotterdam in September. Visit foodmatterslive.com to register and join us as we inspire the future of food.